From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
In the first grade at Henry Charles Lee School in West Philadelphia, when Kenya told kids that she celebrated Kwanzaa, no one knew what she was talking about.
Today we talk with Asali Solomon, the author of Disgruntled, a new novel about race, class, and identity. It's told through the eyes of a girl named Kenya, who's growing up in the 80s, the daughter of Afrocentric parents.
One of the things in the novel that's based in truth is that we did go around giving Kwanzaa programs. I would call it Kwanzaa Von Trapp family.
Also, Charlie Sifford, the first black golfer admitted into the PGA and the first to play in the PGA Tour, died Tuesday. We'll hear an excerpt of my 1992 interview with him.
I always wondered why that they didn't want a black man to play golf. I don't know what they're afraid of.
That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I just read a novel I really like called Disgruntled, about a girl named Kenya who's growing up in the 80s, the daughter of black nationalist Afrocentric parents. My guest is the author, Asali Solomon. Her main character, Kenya, feels like an outsider in her neighborhood school in West Philadelphia because she's considered a gifted student. But when she's sent to a private school, she's an outsider because she's one of the few African-American students, and she feels guilty that she's not measuring up to the model she thinks she's supposed to be portraying. The brilliant black girl, quote, heir to those brave children in the South who'd shine their shoes each morning only to get kicked and spat on in their fight for a good education, unquote. Many of the suburban white students mistakenly assume that everyone in Kenya's neighborhood is on welfare. The novel is rich with perceptions about race, class, the impact of divorce on a child, and growing up with a father whose politics and philosophy is sometimes used as an excuse to justify his irresponsible behavior. Disgruntled is Asali Solomon's first novel. Her previous book, Get Down, is a collection of short stories. In 2007, she was named one of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35. She teaches English literature and creative writing at Haverford College. Asali Solomon, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to read from the very beginning of your novel.
Okay, thank you. So here we go. In the first grade at Henry Charles Lee School in West Philadelphia, when Kenya told kids that she celebrated Kwanzaa, no one knew what she was talking about. By the third grade, led by the tiny tyrant Letitia Simmons, the kids were calling her an African booty scratcher and chanting to a conga line rhythm. You don't get no presents. You don't get no presents. In fact, she did get presents on the last morning of Kwanzaa, 7 days after Christmas. By the fourth grade, Kenya was down to one friend. It wasn't just the Kwanzaa problem. And anyway, she could have lied about Kwanzaa like she suspected Fatima McCullers did. Fatima, whose dad had dreadlocks and who always said Christmas and Santa Claus with a wavering inflection. It was also that she couldn't eat any pork, including the bologna sandwiches that were the everyday fare of the lunchroom, something to do with her father muttering that white people force slaves to eat hog guts, though as far as Kenya could see, white people loved bologna enough to give it both a first and a second name. It was that she wasn't allowed to watch Gimme a Break, Good Times, or Different Strokes, because, according to her mother, watching black people on TV acting the fool was worse than not watching any at all. It was that she was forbidden to actually speak the Pledge of Allegiance and had been directed to mouth it with her hand, not actually touching her chest. It was that she had to call her father Baba, and when she'd ask if she could call him Daddy like other people, it had triggered what seemed like days of lectures, during which Kenya learned to hate the phrase other people. It was that while her parents said grace like normal people, they directed it to the Creator instead of God.
And that's Asali Solomon reading from her new novel, Disgruntled. Does any of this describe how you were raised?
So, yeah, some of the things, we celebrated Kwanzaa. I don't know that my parents, like, specifically forbade us to say the Pledge of Allegiance, but there was something about that. Like, we should not be saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Like, it was a farce. We didn't eat pork, although the reason for that was never quite explained to me. Like, even much later, I was like, why didn't we eat pork? Well, it's not good for you. But I think maybe my parents didn't like it. But it was part of a thing at the time that I think people were taking from black Muslims. And it was also true that when I went to public school in West Philadelphia, I was not in the majority. But the lifestyle I was leading was different from what other people were leading. You know, like my parents taught us to revere Africa. People at school made fun of Africa. So a lot of things like that were true.
Did your parents consider themselves Black nationalists or Afrocentric?
Yeah, I think they considered themselves Black nationalists. But the phrase Black nationalist, I think, implies a level of action that doesn't necessarily describe them. So it was that they thought about themselves as being a part of an entity that was Black people in America, right? As opposed to just thinking of oneself as an American and thinking of oneself as necessarily kind of in opposition to kind of mainstream America. And as for being Afrocentric, I mean, they named my sister and I, they gave us African names. We celebrated Kwanzaa, which is not an African holiday. It's an African-American holiday, but it is based on a reverence for and a connection to Africa. So in that way, yeah.
You know, one of the things I just really enjoyed about reading your novel is I'm always so interested in what it's like for the children of parents who have carved out a way of being different, mm-hmm. who are consciously like rejecting mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. And have this kind of alternate philosophy, whether it's Afrocentrism mm-hmm. or being not that these two are the equivalent of, or being a hippie or mm-hmm. like rejecting religion yeah. or being politically radical or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, to have like their own culture or counterculture. Mm-hmm. And for the children who didn't choose that and who might feel different from the mm-hmm. other children in their school or their neighborhood, to grow up in that. And what it makes them feel peculiar or different as a result of. Mm-hmm. And your book is just filled with insights about that, I think.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the things in the novel is Kenya sort of going in and out of knowing Commodore and them trying to suss out what it means.
Explain who Commodore is.
Oh, Commodore is a little boy whose parents are in the group that Kenya's parents form, the 7 Days. And, you know, they go in and out of each other's lives, trying to think about what it meant for them to be different, both from, you know, the other working class or middle class Black people they knew. And then, you know, in the settings they go in that are predominantly white, what it means to be different. And I think that depending on the things your parents ask you to do, the kind of sacrifices they ask you to make, it can be empowering to know that, you know, the reason you feel like you're not at ease is can be explained by these things versus I think. Almost everybody feels like at a certain point, particularly during the process of coming age, that they're not at ease. They don't fit in, but have no reason for that. Oh, there must be something wrong with me, you know, kind of a thing. So there can be something strengthening about it. But also, you know, when all you really want to do is fit in, and then it can be very difficult.
And you know? I was thinking about that reading your book. Like in the reading that you did, you mentioned the shows that the mother in the book didn't want the kid
yeah, that,
to watch.
Oh, yeah, that was – I forgot. Right? So that was
because,
a thing in our
house. Black people
as
are
well.
Acting like fools on it right. and better not to see anything. And then right. one of Kenya's parents' friends says to Kenya, why are you watching the Muppets? There's no Black Muppets.
Yeah, right.
Like you shouldn't be watching this.
Yeah.
And it just made me think about how consciousness raising when you're doing it right. with children also comes with all these – prescriptions of things that you can't do that are going to
right.
like remove you from other people of your age and from the popular culture of the time, even if the racially conscious perceptions about that culture might be accurate, but it's still, you're just a kid.
Yeah.
When parents are telling you that.
No, and I mean, you know, I went to kindergarten, definitely told some people Santa Claus didn't exist. And, you know, those television shows, I mean, it wasn't so much that I was forbidden to watch those television shows, but, you know, it was kind of frowned upon to be watching a lot of those television shows. And I, you know, I had a breakdown for each of them, why they were nefarious, you know. And it is very hard to be a child living a righteous lifestyle, you know, and explain that to your friends and still be a part of things.
The parents in the novel are always referring to the word the community, and you know, the things they need to do for the community. Did your parents use that expression, and what did it mean in your family?
They did. They would talk about the community, and that meant Black people, and more closely, it meant working class Black people in Philadelphia, or, you know, just Black people in Philadelphia. I mean, I guess the thing that was funny about it is that was one of those things that I didn't think was particularly exotic until much later when I realized that other people did not go around talking about the community and what we needed to do for the community. But again, what it meant was that we were part of this entity And we should always sort of be bearing in mind how we were representing that entity or what we were doing for that entity.
In the novel, the main character's parents and a group of the parents' friends form a group called the Seven Days. And it's inspired by a Toni Morrison novel called Song of Solomon. I want you to explain the connection between the Toni Morrison novel and the Seven Days group.
So in Song of Solomon, Milkman is the main character of the novel, and it's basically a quest novel where Milkman is kind of trying to find himself. He has a best friend named Guitar who joins a radical group called the Seven Days. And the Seven Days, essentially, when they hear of a black person who's been murdered, they go out and murder an equivalent white person in an equivalent way. And, I mean, I think what Morrison was trying to do in that novel is explore the lure of violence. Like, it seems like a good way to assert black humanity in a way and a good way to get back at oppression. But by the end, I think, you know, the novel seems to come to the conclusion that that is crazy and it will drive you crazy. And by the end of the novel, Guitar is quite insane and possibly trying to murder Milkman. The Seven Days in the book is a group where John Brown and Sheila, who don't agree on a lot.
Those are the parents.
Who often don't agree on things like what they're reading, have both read and loved this novel. And they have this idea for a group called the Seven Days. And originally, John Brown really wants it to be a combination of sort of service to the community and acts of anarchy and not violent, but kind of aggressive acts. But it becomes that the parents and their friends do these acts of community service, you know, one day a week, kind of like the Seven Days. So that's the connection there.
Was service an issue in your family? Was that emphasized in your family?
Yes, it was. I mean, my parents worked hard, so they didn't have tons of leisure time. But it was more of a thing like going to marches, going to rallies. There were different kinds of things that they did. My mother started a group called Sisters Remember Malcolm, and she and some friends of hers had this organization that every year would throw a commemorative program honoring Malcolm X. And this was in the days when Malcolm X was a lot less well-known than he is today. We also, I mean, one of the things in the novel that's based in truth is that we did go around giving Kwanzaa programs. I would call it Kwanzaa Von Trapp family because we'd been to the library, we'd go to schools, and I mean, it was torture. I mean, ironically, now I do this at my son's daycare, but go around doing that. So there were things that we did. Yeah, for the community.
Do you still celebrate Kwanzaa with your children?
I do. I mean, in my house, I married a Jewish man, and we celebrate everything except Christmas. So we celebrate. But it's like, I mean, this year it was like 15 days of madness. You know, it's just like, it doesn't stop. But we celebrate Kwanzaa. But yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Asali Solomon, and her new novel is called Disgruntled. The father in your novel sees himself as a radical force for social change, and he sees himself as a philosopher, and he's writing his great text, which mm-hmm. is called The Key, and he describes it as a contemporary work of black philosophy that would also be a way of living for non-black peoples who were enlightened. It would draw on classical thought as well as West African and Native American ways of knowing. It would unite Du Bois, Ellison, Cleaver, Muhammad Ali, and Malcolm X. Very, very ambitious work. But the father is really a mix of radical politics, philosophy, and a lot of BS.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's never going to finish this work.
No.
And the work is really, what's the right word to use to describe it?
Bombastic?
That's good.
I mean, just
confusing.
Confusing.
A mess.
Yeah, a way of not living his life.
And not being responsible to the people in his life.
Right.
Because there's always this, like, great text that's more important than we are.
Right.
That he's working on.
I mean, the father is, it's funny because more than necessarily being a type of a black father, he's definitely a type of a man, you know, in a lot of ways. And actually, I didn't realize this. I was was writing it, and then in the middle of writing it, I reread the novel Middlemarch. And there's a key in Middlemarch, right? So Dorothea, who's one of the protagonists of Middlemarch, marries this older man who she reveres for his mind. But he's always, you know, in his library writing the key to all mythology, I think it's called. And I think that it sort of impressed me, like this thought that, you know, their lives should be sacrificed for this thing that was never going to see the light of day, that no one really cared about, but, you know, was meant to be so meaningful. And Dorothea had to, like, bring him tea, but she wasn't allowed to talk to him at certain times of day. So I think I was sort of thinking about that when I thought of the key. But, yeah, it becomes a way of him just sort of being involved with his own mind and revering his own mind versus living with other people and taking their concerns into account.
Were you exposed to people like that who thought of themselves as being great minds and great philosophers, and you would assume that they were a genius because you never got to see the work? Do you know? Like,
yeah.
It's easy to be brilliant when nobody sees the brilliant
right.
thing that you're working on. I've known that person.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I can't think of anybody I've known like that personally. The one thing that, and this is not, my father's not John Brown by any stretch of the imagination, but he was a songwriter. And it was not his vocation. It was his passion. And he spent a lot of time in the living room playing the piano. And then at one point he had a studio in the basement. And so he spent a lot of time doing that. But I don't think of it in this way like he was working on some nonsense that, you know, he thought was going to change the world or anything like that. But I think the image of a male figure in the house working away on something separate from other parts of the house may have come into that.
Books play a really interesting part in your novel because mm-hmm. there's a group the parents form that's inspired by a Toni Morrison novel.
Mm-hmm.
The father is hard at work on this philosophical tome mm-hmm. that he'll never finish. Mm-hmm. No one will ever read it. It's not going to amount to anything. And the mother is introduced to Audre Lorde. Mm-hmm. And Audre Lorde, who's a lesbian feminist mm-hmm. author, let me just quote what the mother says to the daughter in this. She says, "I don't go in for that gay stuff, but everything else that this sister said is all right by me." And the father says, "Oh, she's probably just an FBI informant."
Right.
And the mother says, "Well, she certainly informed me about why I'm not ironing your shirts or pouring your cereal anymore."
Right.
That strikes me as such a kind of, I've heard that argument. You know, like you read a book, you change your mind
mm-hmm.
And you argue about who you're going to be after that and what you're going to do or not do. And I'm wondering if you were exposed to that as a child, to that kind of argument based on ideas, on new ideas that the adults were getting exposed to that were changing their sense of who they were and what mm-hmm. they wanted out of life. And you were maybe seeing this but too young to really grasp what
yeah.
was going on.
I mean, so I don't remember anything like that. There was a funny thing in there, which is that my mother, as far as I can remember, has been a feminist. And that was another thing that I didn't realize was slightly unusual in a household like mine. I mean, but also I think a lot of working class black women and educated black women, my mother's educated, both my parents are, went to college, are feminists but wouldn't articulate it as such, whereas my mother would pretty much articulate it as such. She would always say things like, people talk about when we got married, she'd say, if you get married, you know, and talk about a lot of things as a choice. Or she would always tell the story of a friend of hers who was raising a child on her own, and somebody would say, oh, you know, you need a husband. And the friend would say, no, I need a wife. So she was very conscious of the hierarchy of gender and these kinds of things.
Now, you mentioned that if you said, when I get married, your mother would say, if you get married.
That's
and
right.
Make it clear you had a choice. You didn't have to get married.
Right.
I hope I'm not giving away too much here. The child in your book, Kenya, finds out her parents actually never got married.
Mm-hmm.
That the father felt like, I don't need the government in our relationship. I don't need a certificate to tell me how I feel or what I should do. And I'm interested in why you created the couple not being married and if that was an issue around you when you were growing up.
So a funny thing is that one time my mom, I don't know what we were doing. I don't know. She sat me down. We were sitting there and she said, you know, your father and I aren't married. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. And I'm struggling because I'm thinking like, Well, my mom is the one who told me not to say illegitimate. It doesn't matter. But at the same time, it kind of does matter. She was lying. This was some kind of weird prank. Like, you know, just to see what you would say, you know. And so I think what I'm doing in the book is thinking about in that moment, I felt like something dropped away, even though I wasn't. I had been taught not to feel that way. I had been taught not to be invested in this foolishness. But
it could have been true in the sense that it would have fit into larger philosophy. I've certainly known plenty of people who decided not to get married in spite of the fact that they were having children, or got married only because they were having children, or after they had children.
No.
But you never know how the children are going to feel about that.
So, I mean, and then so it did take me a while to figure out, for example, that like the anniversary of my parents' marriage and my birthday didn't really line. Like, my mom's pregnant when they got married. Like, you could see it in the pictures. Like, but, you know, for years I had been looking at those pictures without the recognition of that. But neither of my parents would have, they probably would not have had children without getting married. I mean, they came from households that were, my mother's parents were not at all traditional people, but I think my grandmother could be kind of a hardliner about certain things like that. I mean, again, my grandmother was like the original Black working class feminist. You know, she didn't need to learn about these things in classes, about equality, about being forthright, about telling men and people exactly what she thought. But I think she believed that you should get married. And my father's parents actually never married. But I think he would have felt like he was doing a disservice to his mother by not marrying a woman who was pregnant with his child. And they claim they wanted to get married anyway. That's what they always say.
My guest, Asali Solomon, is the author of the new novel Disgruntled, a novel about race, class, identity, and the impact of divorce on a child. It's told from the point of view of a girl named Kenya, growing up in the 80s in West Philadelphia, the daughter of Black nationalist Afrocentric parents. So one of the family issues in the book that really breaks up the family is that the father in the novel ends up having an affair with one of the mother's good friends.
One of the 7 days.
Who's also a member of the group, the 7 days. And this woman gets pregnant with Kenya's father. And so Kenya's father makes this offer to Kenya and her mother that they could just expand the family and welcome in, you know, this other person and this other person's baby. Would you read that passage from your novel?
Sure. So this is John Brown, the father, talking to Sheila and Kenya after Sheila discovers he's been having an affair.
And Sheila is
the mother.
Kenya's mother.
Mother. With your permission, Sheila and Kenya, I'd like for Cindy Lou and the baby to move in here. I'd like for us all to be a family. What did you say? Sheila asked. She dabbed at her mouth with a napkin and looked genuinely as if she hadn't heard, as if she was asking for a small clarification. Did you say cream or sugar? Lemonade? You want me to pass the lemonade? Well, Cindaloo and I have been going to some events at the Yoruba Temple and, oh, you actually go out of the house. Glad to hear that. And I don't think the temple is for me. I mean, organized religion is organized religion. But some of the families in the traditional African, get back to the point. So you want to move that bitch and her bastard up in here, where I pay the mortgage? I'm not understanding what this has to do with the temple, because from what I know about traditional West African polygamy, Lord Jesus have mercy, the man supports the family. No, brother, I make the money. And here she laughed. What you're proposing is pimping, and I am not a whore.
Thank you for reading that. And that's Asali Solomon reading from her new novel, Disgruntled. I love the way he's gotten this woman pregnant. He wants to, like, move her in with this new baby into the family and basically be polygamous. And he's got this philosophy that's going to justify it. It's not like he was philandering. You know, it's like he was being disloyal, unfaithful. It's like, no, no, it's like African tradition of polygamy. And it's, you know, there's the hippie version of that, too.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Of course.
There's the white hippie version of
that. Yeah, that's not that's not specific to – I mean, you know, the scenario is specific to Black people, but I don't think that impulse to sort of like rationalize your behavior with, you know, some greater philosophy is – you know, I think that's a universal desire. But I also want to say, just as a side note, that apparently is my father's favorite scene in the book.
Really?
He thought that was hilarious. He laughs just talking about it, so I'm glad I got a chance to read it.
But I'm interested in hearing why you wanted a scene like that. Why you thought that the next step for this character who's writing this great philosophical text that's in some ways just removing him from any responsibility because he's always busy writing this great mm-hmm. philosophical text, why the next step would be this elaborate philosophical justification for his philandering.
Yeah, I mean, John Brown's activism and his philosophy has an interesting relationship to his personal story, which is that he had these distant, mean, snobby parents who wanted him to be, you know, respectable middle class in this way that ultimately is racially self-loathing, and it hurt him. And so a lot of what he does is reasonable on some level, you know, considering racism and police brutality and these kinds of things. But on some level, it's this extended acting out against his parents. And so he feels justified in making these moves that are kind of self-serving through this political, you know, through a sort of political rationalization. And so it starts with this extended acting out against his parents, and it continues with this kind of thing, you know, acting out in his family life, in the family that he's built.
Did you know people who tried to justify breaking monogamy with, you know, elaborate philosophical?
I don't know anybody who personally has done that, but I have certainly heard that, mm-hmm. you know, certainly heard that it's not natural. You know, I mean, and so like you keep saying the hippie version, but, you know, it's not natural for men to be monogamous. And so I've heard people talk about them in the sense of thinking about African families and people who are not sort of properly interested in what that polygamy looks like, which is what Sheila points out. But just generally thinking like, well, you know, mixing just their desire to with something that's broader, you know, and more profound.
The daughter in your novel, the main character, mm-hmm. Kenya, ends up going to a private school in Philadelphia's main line mm-hmm. that's in Bryn Mawr.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
As you did.
Right.
And for her, it's a kind of life-changing experience, both in terms of this new form of alienation that she's never experienced before, mm-hmm. but also she gets a terrific education there. Mm-hmm. How what was going to a predominantly white private school like for you?
So it was obviously alienating in a lot of ways. I mean, I certainly got an excellent education, but I guess it took me a long time to understand the mix of feelings I have about that. It's something I've written about a lot and thought about a lot because the school, it was a great school. It was, you know, aesthetically, it was beautiful. I got to do so many things, you know. But I always felt just kind of cold and out of it there. I often felt just kind of cold and out of it. And there were things that were clearly that could clearly explain this. Like, you know, people really would ask me questions about the city, like were there pools of blood on the ground? And people would say things that were either subtly or not so subtly racist. And class was a big issue, right? A lot of the kids were wealthy and we weren't poor, but we weren't wealthy. We didn't have a lot of money. And, you know, that was just something that was always there. You know, I was very nervous about people coming to my house, which in a lot of cases they were not even allowed to do because they weren't allowed to, like, come to West Philadelphia. But I think that recently I was thinking about how to articulate it. And I would say that in that situation, I and a lot of the other black students were just marginal because we were black. We would never be at the core of the social experience of that school, I felt, because we were black. And that sense only would increase as, I mean, I didn't go to high school there, but I imagine would have only increased as people got into dating because they weren't going to be dating out there, you know?
Well, in the novel, the girl's thinking, everybody's doing everything possible to separate her from the white boys.
Right.
And you get the feeling everybody in her family as well as right. people in the school, because her parents don't want her dating somebody who's white.
Yeah. Well, but then the other part of it is that there were black boys, and this was the case, you know, when I went to Baldwin, there were black boys sort of on the scene, you know, but they were not interested either. And, you know, I mean, there was this phenomenon that would occur when I went to school dances that I think I've documented pretty extensively, where you would have a sprinkling of black students, but the black boys did not want anybody to know that they were black. They wouldn't know. You, like, by asking a black girl to – like, if you asked a black girl to dance, that would be like admitting that you were black. Obviously, they were black. It was, you know – but they couldn't ask a white girl to dance because there was something off about that. So they would often ask, like, sort of ethnically indeterminate girls to dance. I mean, you know, but this kind of weird politicking that would go on. So it was, yeah. So, I mean, so, like, I imagine, so in middle school, you know, there's not so much dating and it's not really so much about a kind of sexual hierarchy. There are other things, but it's very difficult to fit in when you're just different and, you know, you can't afford or your parents won't buy the same things that everybody else is wearing. You're not going on ski trips. And, you know, it's just everyone just thinks of you as different because you're black, but they're never saying it.
My guest, Asali Solomon, is the author of the new novel, Disgruntled, about a girl named Kenya growing up in Philadelphia in the 80s, the daughter of Afrocentric parents. When her parents divorce, her mother remarries and moves to a suburb where Kenya is sent to a private school. Like Kenya, Solomon switched from a predominantly black public school to a predominantly white private school. Do you think you were exposed to ideas and books that you wouldn't have been exposed to had you stayed in a neighborhood public school?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's just, you know, I remember reading Jane Eyre in sixth grade, and then later, you know, I read in high school, and I already read that. And I started taking French in fourth grade. I mean, sure, that definitely happened.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah, it was a good thing. It was a good thing. But it's very, I mean, it's the thing that's difficult about quote-unquote good schools where you feel alienated or socially marginal is that depending on who you are as a person, you can make it out of that, you know, and write fiction about the pain that you experience in that. But a different kind of person won't necessarily get the benefit of the education because they're so broken as a person by that experience. So that's a kind of risk there.
So you were raised in West Philadelphia in a neighborhood that was part of the neighborhood that was predominantly African-American?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. But you went to a private school on Philadelphia's main line that was predominantly white.
Right.
And you now teach at Haverford College, which
right.
is on the main line. Do you live near the college? And how have you dealt with what you want to expose your two children to in terms of, like, the racial and class environment they grew up in? And I know your husband is white. So it's complicated.
It is. But we live in the city.
You live in the
we
city.
We live in West Philadelphia.
Oh, you live in West Philadelphia.
So you know, so we live in West Philadelphia. And
near the street where you grew up or a different
yeah,
part of
no,
it?
Yeah, no, I live in it's a different area and, you know, the neighborhood has
This is also the neighborhood that the University of Pennsylvania is in.
Yeah, the neighborhood's become significantly whiter. And I mean, but one thing I should say about I grew up in West Philadelphia, and it was in a black neighborhood. But I always thought of Penn as part of that geography, mm-hmm. even though we weren't, you know, on the campus or anything like that. And I think Penn, the presence of University of Pennsylvania, definitely, like, shapes part of what goes on in that neighborhood in terms of, like, the sort of black eccentricity that goes on, I think, in that neighborhood, like the specificity. But I live really close to where my parents are. So I actually live and my kids go to lessons at the YMCA where I would sometimes do things and spend a lot of time at the library, the 52nd Street Library, which I you know, I mean, they're like, I would go there after school and I mean, they took care of us, you know. So they're the things they're being exposed to are similar in some ways to a lot of the things that I was exposed to. And I mean, there are very different things, but I think like the thing that I'm trying to negotiate as a parent is how to teach them about what I view as the realities of life in the world and life in America without, you know, terrifying them.
So your name, Asali, is a Swahili word for honey. So your parents intentionally gave you an African name. Mm-hmm. When it came time for you to name your children, how did you decide what level of symbolism you wanted those names to have?
So they both have African names. I have a son, Adebayo. His name is Yoruba. It's apparently a somewhat popular name in Nigeria. A funny story about that is I have a British friend who said, oh, and it means born at a joyful time. And he said, oh, to us it means bratty, overpaid, you know, football player, you know, because in Europe, in England, like, apparently they're football soccer players named Adebayo. But Mkale means ancestor. That's Swahili. And they both have my last name for their middle name. And their last name is Friedman, which is a Jewish name. So it's kind of all in there.
Great. It's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Asali Solomon is the author of the new novel, Disgruntled. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Charlie Sifford, the first black player admitted into the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, who was also the first black man to play on the PGA Tour, died Tuesday night at the age of 92. We're going to listen back to my 1992 interview with him. To get into the PGA in 1960, Sifford had to challenge the Caucasian Clause. That clause, which remained in the association's constitution until 1961, stated professional golfers of the Caucasian race over the age of 18 shall be eligible for membership. During Sifford's career, he won over $1 million in official prize money. In 2004, he became the first African-American inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. President Obama presented him with the Presidential Medal of Freedom last November. I spoke with Sifford when his memoir, Just Let Me Play, was published. He said then that there was still no place for a black man in professional golf. Of course, that was before Tiger Woods. Yesterday, Woods said, without Sifford, I probably wouldn't be here. He paved the way for a lot of us. Here's my interview with Sifford. Your introduction to golf was as a caddy at a country club in North Carolina. It is a country club that blacks were not allowed to be members of. Blacks were not allowed to actually play on the course. So how did you actually learn to play on a whites-only course when you were a caddy?
I guess it's just a gift from God, you know, because I used to get out and I'm from a very, very poor family. I had my father and mother, they had six kids, and my father was a laborer. And when I'd get out of school in the afternoon, I would go to the golf course, and I just picked the game up. And when I was 13 years old, I could shoot 70, even par, 71, one over par, and it's something like that. It took a liking to the game.
Would you have to sneak onto the course to play, or would they let you play as a caddy even though the course was officially closed to blacks?
Well, we had a day we called Caddy Day Monday. But sometime I would slip out on the golf course, and that's why the gentleman that owned it, Sutton Alexander, very nice man, and God bless him, he passed, and he used to let me take me out and we play, you know, but after all the members of the golf course got talking about it, so he asked my mother and father if they would let me go somewhere where I could play golf, and that was to Philadelphia. I had an uncle up there, and I went to Philadelphia in 1939.
Because there was a public course nearby that you could play on.
Right, it's still there.
Now, you became Billy Eckstein's golf teacher, valet, and partner on the course.
Mm-hmm.
So you traveled with the band?
Oh, yeah.
That must have been fun.
I was in charge of the musicians, and I was in charge of taking his clothes to the theater, and when I'd take his clothes to the theater, I would head for the golf course, wherever I could find one, and do my little thing.
So, now, Eckstein played golf, and you say that you used to hustle with Eckstein. What were your hustles like?
I taught him how to play golf. We used to go to these different cities, you know, and you know how some of the guys are. You see Bill Eckstein making all this money, so they try to sneak out to the golf course and rob him. So we were prepared for that. We used to go in different places, you understand, and the guys used to call him up to come play. So he said, okay, but I had to bring my my chauffeur with me. You know, I was the chauffeur and the pro, too. So we used to go out, and if I see that the guys couldn't beat him, you understand, I'd be playing turkey. I'd be hitting my ball all out through the woods and anywhere until things get real tough, then I would come in, you know.
Now, you say that being the first black on the PGA Tour was one of the most frightening and dangerous things you ever faced. What was dangerous about it?
Well, could you imagine a black man going to North Carolina to play in a PGA-sponsored golf tournament with all white players and one black the first time it ever happened? That's enough to be afraid of. And
were you threatened?
Oh, yes. After the first round of the tournament, I shot 68 and led the tournament the first day. And went back to these friends' house I lived in. It wasn't in the hotels. And the phone rang, and they asked to speak to Charlie Siffert. So I answered the phone. So this guy said, "You a Charlie Siffert?" So I said, "Yeah." So he said, "You better not bring your back to the golf course tomorrow." So I told him, I said, "Well, I tee off at 9:40, and what are you going to do? You better get ready to do it because I'll be there." So I went out, teed off, and about 10 or 12 guys started on number one, and it took them to the 14th hole before they could arrest them all.
What were they doing?
Hollering, yelling, calling me names. Didn't hit me, which thank God they didn't do. I'm sure I wouldn't, you know, may not have been here today as a successful black professional. Well, that's why I said that Jack Robinson, you understand, he's in a different category to me than he was in a ballpark. See, I'm between those ropes and touchable, you know. Anything could happen. But in the ballpark, he's more safer than I were.
Of course, he had a lot of things thrown at him, didn't he?
He had 8 guys with him anyway, you know. And I'm nobody but me and 14 golf clubs.
Well, how did you golf that day? You know, there's such a hush that falls over the crowd when somebody is taking their swing, and here you had all these hostile people out to get you who were hollering and insulting you as you were playing. Did you play well that day?
I think I shot 73 that day.
What was par?
71. I played well behind that because, you know, I had made up my mind I was going to go through with it anyway, you know, as long as someone didn't hit me, you know. Ain't nothing they can do to turn me around, you know, to break my concentration and break my determination because I had started and I wasn't going to quit.
Now, what would happen when you would play in a tournament on a course or in a club that barred blacks? Were you allowed in the clubhouse? Were you allowed in the locker room?
At the first beginning, I wasn't allowed in the club, and I wasn't allowed in the I had to go in the locker room to eat. I couldn't eat with them.
When did that start changing?
Oh, it started after 64, 65.
Mm-hmm. How much golf are you playing now?
Oh, I play golf just about every week. I'm playing on the senior tour now. Super seniors. I'm a super senior.
That's one of the really great things about golf, isn't it, that you don't have to give it up?
That's right. You can play till you get 100. Because if you take care of yourself like me, exercise, train, stay away from the ladies.
Do you feel that you still face discrimination?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, I believe that now don't get me wrong, I'm not prejudiced. There's some white people in this country will never accept a black man as a golfer. That's true.
Now, why do you think that is? What is it about golf that has been so resistant?
I don't know. That's what the first, when I was 13 years old and had to leave North Carolina to come to Pennsylvania to play golf, I always wondered why that they didn't want a black man to play golf. I've proved everything. I proved to the world that a black man could play golf and be a gentleman. They never seen me out on the tour with three or four different women. They've never seen me with no women. I've never been with any. They've never saw me bothering any of their wives. So I don't know what they're afraid of. And we outnumbered anyway. If they had 20 blacks out there, well, hell, you got 4,500 whites. So, I mean, you know, well, what is it? We don't have any tails. I just don't understand it.
So what's your next big game?
Oh, I'm going to Charlotte, North Carolina, my hometown, to play next week.
Oh, and that's you're not going to be on the course where you got started, are you?
No. No, we built another golf course. I wasn't allowed there either. But that don't bother me anymore. I just go out there and take off my shoes, go in the locker room, do just like the rest of them do, and better not be stopped. They don't. They know who I am, and they know I might fight back now. Before, I wouldn't fight back because I had to prove a point. But the point is proven now, and I'm proud of my book. And I know that some of the kids that read this book that want to gonna get interested in golf, I know we have some golfers out there. We just have to find them.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to you.
Charlie Sifford recorded in 1992. He died Tuesday at the age of 92. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's show.
Traffic accident? Better call Saul.
Saul Goodman, the sleazy, fast-talking lawyer from Breaking Bad, now has a spin-off series about to premiere on AMC called Better Call Saul. We'll feature our interview with Bob Odenkirk, who plays Saul. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years.